All right. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will be heard. Bless the United States and this honor. Excuse me.
Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Allen, and I'm joined by Judges Peach, Toth, and Lauer on my right, and Judges Bartley, Falvey, and Jaquith on my left. And we're convened this morning to consider arguments in the matter of David W. Barringer versus Douglas A. Collins, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 23-7995. Would counsel, beginning with appellate's counsel, enter your appearance for the record?
Thank you, Your Honor. Amy Odom of the law firm Chisholm Chisholm Kilpatrick, and with me at counsel table is Zachary Stoltz.
Thank you very much. Secretary's counsel?
David LeBlanc and Kenneth Walsh for the secretary.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Odom, it looks like you want to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then we'll make that happen, and you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Chief Judge Allen. Good morning, and may it please the court. Mr. Barringer filed a supplemental claim within a year of the October 2021 board decision denying TDIU. The agency of original jurisdiction issued a decision on that supplemental claim under Section 5104. Under Section 2X1 of the AMA, then, all of the AMA rules apply to Mr. Barringer's claim. And the plain language of the AMA version of Section 5110A2D says that if you file a supplemental claim within a year of a board decision, that's continuous pursuit. 5110A2D doesn't ask if the board decision was issued under the legacy or the AMA rules. It asks one question: was there a board decision and a supplemental claim within a year? Because the continuous pursuit rules apply to Mr. Barringer's claim and he continuously pursued his TDIU, we respectfully ask the court to reverse the board's dismissal of his appeal. I welcome the court's questions.
I do have a question right off the bat, is why didn't he, your client, opt into the AMA beforehand? He was given three notices that he had this option. Why didn't he exercise that option?
Your Honor, I can't know what was going through Mr. Barringer's head when he received these notices from the VA. There are a lot of reasons why people didn't opt in. Perhaps he found the notices confusing. Perhaps he didn't understand what these new three review options were. It's unclear. But what is clear is that Congress did anticipate that some people, like Mr. Barringer, would stay in legacy. This was a feature of the dual system, not a flaw. Some people had to stay in legacy so that the AMA system wasn't overwhelmed. That's clear from the legislative history. And there's no indication in the history or in the structure or text of the AMA that Congress intended that those folks who stayed in legacy would be penalized by being entitled to less of an amount of compensation than would a veteran who opted in from the legacy into AMA.
Do you have anything, though, that you can – let's just assume that we were going to look at legislative history on this. And you point to the plain language of a board decision. And then on the other side, there's the plain language, if you will, about how you can opt into the AMA from the legacy. Are you with me?
Yes. That,
right? Okay.
Yes.
So assume with me then that the plain language only gets you to a point where you say there's two different plain language approaches here that can help us. So then if we look at the legislative history, is there anything in the legislative history that suggests that Congress was thinking that this was another way into the system?
Well, Your
AMA
Honor,
system?
Your Honor, I'll get to the legislative history, but I would stop at the plain language analysis, because if you look at 2X1, the very first words are "except as otherwise provided." That means that 2X1 is the general rule. You look to see if you have a 5104 decision after February 2019. If yes, that's the end. You don't go to the exceptions, including X5, which is the exception if you have a legacy. He didn't have a legacy claim in in February 2019 after the AOJ issued the.
Well, but another way to look at it is he didn't have any claim at all, right? I mean, in other words, you're assuming that the legacy, you agree that the board decision that in which he then followed up with a supplemental claim within a year, that board decision was a legacy board decision.
That's right.
Okay. So one way to look at this is as you're looking at it, which is the legacy board decision exists, and then the filing of the supplemental claim within a year essentially continues the claim, but now it's an AMA claim because we have the decision on the supplemental claim. That's one way, right?
Right.
Another way to look at it is the board decision was a legacy board decision, and it could never become anything other than a legacy board decision. And so that claim could have been kept alive by appealing to the court, but it wasn't. And so that claim stream dies, my words, just it stops. And then a new stream begins. So why should we pick one over another?
There's nothing in Section 2X that supports the latter interpretation. 2X1 is a general rule. You fit the general rule, you don't go to the exception. That's how legislative interpretation generally works. And the legacy claim often is an exception to the general rule if you have a 5104 decision after 2019. To look at it any other way is to inject language into both 5110A2D, right? Now you have to inject into 5110A2D a AMA board decision or a decision under the new system or something. That language is not there, and it's a well-held principle that courts should not write new language into a statute that's not there. And it would require writing that language in. In terms of the legislative history, I mean, I think everybody agrees that Congress didn't intend that legacy would go on forever, that the claim could never get out of legacy. That's just not how the system works. Eventually, Congress clearly intended that the AMA system would completely displace the legacy system. And the way that it happened...
On that front, I mean, did 5110 change how we define finality? Right? Because my understanding is if you look at the legacy system, you would look at 7104... You would look at the timing for filing an NOD or whether someone filed an NOD, and then you could kind of back out and determine whether something was final based on whether somebody took the next step in the kind of statutory appointed time. It appears like 5110 has sort of changed how finality itself is calculated with the continuous pursuit.
Yes, Your Honor, that was a major, major feature of the AMA system, is that there's essentially no finality anymore. You can file a supplemental claim every year until eternity and keep the proceedings going. I mean, we know from Lloyd that you have...
But, I mean, the continuous pursuit operates something like finality, right? Because if it's outside of the 1 year,
right,
it would function much like finality functioned in legacy.
Yes, under 5104C, if you don't file the supplemental claim within a year of the decision on the claim, then it becomes a new adjudicative... process. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about this specific time frame that the system was transitioning from legacy and AMA, and how did it happen on a claim-by-claim basis. It could happen if you didn't have a 5104 decision after 2019. It could happen through the opt-in after an SOC or an SSOC. Mr. Berenger, for reasons that I can't know, but I can say, you know, from a pro se veteran's perspective, these notices could be confusing, and they're talking about three different review levels that are not very intuitive for a person without a lot of training or experience in this area to understand what the differences are. And all that they told them in the notices were, it's a new efficient process, you have more choices, and it doesn't matter what choice you have, what choice you make, you can keep your effective date. Well, that was true in legacy too, right? Like in legacy, you had one choice, you could go to the board on appeal and you keep the effective date. So 5110A did create a new system of continuing to pursue a claim, but in terms of the effective date, it's the same as it was in legacy. If you submitted new and material evidence within a year, you got the same effective date. So the effective date stuff wasn't really what the big feature of the process was that they were selling to claimants. It was that there was an efficient process with new new choices and perhaps an earlier resolution.
Ms. Odom, can you point to any other indication that Congress intended other ways for a legacy appeal to convert to an AMA appeal that you haven't mentioned? In other words, where is Congress intent outside of the opt-in procedures under 3.2400 and 5110?
Well, there is X3, which was for the period between 2017 and 2019 that allowed veterans to ask or claimants to ask for the new system to apply to the claim, though I'm not sure that that VA ever implemented that. But that was another way that Congress indicated that these claims could go from the legacy system into the AMA system. But those are all situations that are exceptions to the general rule. Again, I know I keep saying this, but I think it's very important. The general rule is once you get that 5104 decision after February 2019, you're in AMA. The decision here that's on appeal to the board is clearly an AMA decision. It has the 5104 review rights. The agency went right to the merits, but I don't think anybody would disagree that if you file a supplemental claim within a year of a legacy board decision, the burden is new and relevant evidence, not new and material evidence. It seems like the only thing that the VA says doesn't apply in Mr. Berenger's situation is 5110A, and for reasons. And that can't be right. It can't be that Congress intended that when you transition to the new system, you're going to get all the benefits and all the rules except for continuous pursuit.
What is the initial decision that led to an administrative appeal?
In this case, for purposes of 19.2 and 3.2400, it's the August 22 rating decision on the supplemental claim. That has to be the initial decision for purposes of the regulation in Maddox. In order to be consistent with Section 2X1, initial has to mean the 5104 decision, the first decision on a supplemental claim or an initial claim. And so we have that 5104 decision here in August 2022. And just on the topic of Maddox, I think it's important to point out that Maddox is fully reconcilable with this position. Maddox is what happens when you don't have a 5104 decision. A board decision under 7104 does not automatically transition a legacy claim into AMA. We know that from Maddox. But Maddox doesn't say anything about what happens when you get the 5104 decision that is explicitly identified in Section 2X. That's this case. And the court should be true to the plain language of Section 2X and find that the AMA rules applied here, and including
this is somewhat along what Judge Lauer was asking, but less technical. It just strikes me that this is one of these, this is like a big feature of the system, right? If we accept the appellant's view, this is a major deal, because anytime the existing legacy system produced a board decision, then the person could file a supplemental claim within a year, and so it would convert all of these things into the AMA. It just seems to me that Congress would have said something a little bit more explicit if that was the way it thought it was going to work. Because you're focusing on a board decision without saying a modernized board decision or a legacy board decision. And I get what you're saying. I do get what you're saying. It's just, this reminds me of the idea that Congress wouldn't, put whatever, elephants in mouse holes or whatever that phrase was. This seems like a really big elephant.
It would be a really big elephant if Congress wanted legacy claims to stay in legacy forever. And there's no language indicating that. Yet that is the position that...
Well, but they provided Congress, it provided ways in which to get from the legacy system into the AMA. I mean, Congress clearly decided, there's no question, Congress intended to have two systems operating simultaneously with the notion that the legacy system was eventually going to get its way down, right? And we see... I mean, the court sees that in the number of cases coming to it that now are about 83% AMA cases versus legacy. So it was going going to do this. I don't think anybody expected that the legacy system would exist into perpetuity. But by the same token, it's just hard for me to see that Congress would have accomplished this entire thing relatively silently.
Again, though, then the truth has to be Congress intended that if you file a supplemental claim within a year of a legacy board decision, the burden is new and relevant evidence. You have AMA review options. You cannot submit evidence during outside of the window evidence windows, but you don't get the benefit of 51A2D. You don't get it. That just doesn't make any sense. I feel like Congress.
Well, you don't get it retroactively. You would get the benefit of that. So let's assume Mr. Berenger files his supplemental claim, okay? And we're not arguing, let's assume you didn't make the argument that you did, okay? But Mr. Berenger files the supplemental claim that he did in this case. And let's just assume the claim is denied, not because of the failure to submit new and relevant evidence. It's denied on we're not going to Lloyd. it's denied on the merits. Mr. Berenger seeks higher level review. That's denied. Goes to the board. The board finds a pre-decision duty to assist. It remands, and this goes on for 6 years. And then eventually one of these VA things grants him the benefit. He would get the benefit of the continuous pursuit by going all the way back to the date of his supplemental claim, assuming that he made kept the potato in the air the entire way, right? So he'd get the benefit of that.
Right, but he's entitled to the full benefit of it.
Well, but that... I get what you're saying, but saying that just presupposes the answer to the question, right? Because one can't say that he gets everything in the AMA except for continuous pursuit, unless you assume that he gets continuous pursuit going all the way back into what was the legacy system. I'm just saying that, say, ruling in the government's favor here would not negate the idea of continuous pursuit for this claim. It just would say that he gets the benefit of continuous pursuit going only back to the filing of this claim.
Well, Your Honor, you brought up this concept of retroactivity. To say that 5110A2D has a retroactive application to somebody who files a supplemental claim within a year of a board decision, you have to go through the Princess Cruz factors.
Yeah, I was using retroactivity as a person on the street, not as a judge, right? In the sense that, right, you know, it's the idea of what does it mean to say you get the benefit of continuous pursuit. And again, this is one of these things where, you know, we assume, I mean, if we're going to go into the whole retroactivity sort of analysis, right, we assume that we're not starting with retroactivity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so to the extent that we have, so I'm not sure that would help Mr. Berenger's position. But when I use retroactivity, I was just meaning that we can't just say blithely that he doesn't get any benefit from continuous pursuit, because he does going forward in his claim.
But not A2D, right? So he gets it for the HLR because he filed the HLR, and he gets it because he appealed to the board and the board remanded and didn't issue a final decision, but he doesn't get the benefit of A2D because the board decision was in legacy.
Right, and that all I'm saying is that leads to the question. I don't think that, for me, that doesn't lead to the answer. It leads to the question.
Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that it does lead to the answer. That's an absurd result that you get 51A D1 AD 3, 4, 5, but not two. That doesn't. It just. There's no textual hook for that. There's no, in my opinion, no structural hook for that, and there's no historical hook for that at all. It's just. It sounds to me a lot like just bringing legacy ideas into AMA. At CCK, we like to call it legacy sizing AMA. And that's what a holding here that 5110A2D did not apply to Mr. Berenger would be doing is bringing the legacy system into a currently pending AMA claim.
Can the initial decision that led to appellate review change throughout the course of a claim?
Yes, I believe.
The position is the initial claim that led to appellate review was not the TDIU related to the PTSD. It was the subsequent filing.
Right. I think it's important to recognize that initial decision has different meanings in the different contexts. We saw that in HELD. There's a different initial decision for fee purposes than there are for 19.2 purposes. But for 19.2 purposes, you have to read the regulation in harmony with 2X1. So initial in the regulation must mean a 5104 decision. And that's the only way that the regulations can be consistent with 2X1.
So under your reading, Congress has established ways to opt into the AMA. Mm-hmm. The Secretary implemented through, for example, RAMP. You would say that filing a supplemental claim would give yet another way, but doing it in a way that is not clear in this case, for a claimant to go back and continuously pursue. In other words, we have established ways that Congress has set and that the Secretary has implemented. You are suggesting there is now another way, based on the general language of Public Law 2X, or in order to do this. So what would be the purpose of having those procedures that Congress clearly gave for opting into the AMA for a legacy claim, a legacy decision, if you could just file a supplemental claim?
Judge Lauer, I want to be clear. Mr. Barringer did not opt into the AMA. Mr. Barringer filed a supplemental claim, and then the law operates to put him in AMA with the supplemental claim. Why do we have these other options like X3 and X5? Those are for folks who did not have a 5104 decision. They wanted to get into AMA for whatever reason, because their attorneys or their VSOs was telling them they wanted to get an AMA before they had a final board decision, before they had a 5104 decision. And Congress provided ways for veterans to do that by opting in after the SSOC or under 3, which, again, I don't think was ever a program that VA implemented.
But you don't dispute that the October 2021 board decision was a legacy decision which became final because Mr. Barringer elected not to opt in or to appeal to this court within the requirements.
It did not become final because he filed a supplemental claim within a year. So just like anybody else who was in AMA who opted in and got an AMA decision, an AMA board decision, if they forewent filing an appeal in 120 days, it did not become final if they filed a supplemental claim within a year.
So filing a supplemental claim can overcome the finality of the board decision that was made in October of 2020.
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly what Calhoun said, how 5110A(d)(2) operates when you're in AMA. And Mr. Barringer is in AMA. Nobody has disputed that this claim is in AMA. The only dispute is whether he's entitled to 5110A2D. That's the only dispute.
So is it, I mean, this is a bit of a technical question, but is it fair to characterize your argument as saying that 5110, the continuous pursuit provisions added by Congress, I don't want to say overruled Rudd, but changed Rudd, because you know, before, so Rudd, you know, freestanding effective date challenges are not allowed, right? And the idea was something's final and you have an effective date. And if you were just allowed to challenge that, it would really defeat finality, right? But it strikes me that with continuous pursuit, as long as you meet the statutory requirements of 5110 for continuous pursuit, Congress is allowing you to really challenge effective dates as long as you meet that continuous pursuit
That's how I understand the court's ruling in Calhoun, is that 5110A changed the structure of the effective date rules, and therefore you can continue to pursue an effective date where you couldn't under legacy.
It's the supplemental claim that's allowed to do that. It doesn't necessarily refer back to what the earlier claim was.
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm not sure I follow.
So again, I mean, I asked earlier about finality and whether 5110 didn't effectively change finality rules. And if it did change finality rules, then something like a freestanding effective date claim, which had been prohibited under Rudd, would now be allowed. And the only qualifier would be it would just simply have to fit the 5110 descriptions for continuous pursuit. Again, I know this is a technical question, but because Rudd is technically what bars the claim here. Right.
Yeah, I, Your Honor, to be frank, I'm a little, I think that I understood this question to be answered by Calhoun. And I don't know, is there a question?
Maybe if we walk it through in steps, right?
Okay.
So 5104 capital CB allows people for more than 1 year after an AOJ decision to file a supplemental claim.
Right.
Right. So they're allowed to. So that presumably would apply to legacy claim, like, you know, 1995. You could file, and if you prevailed on your claim, like every claim you prevail on, they would then go to 5110 to assign an effective date, and they would say, okay, we can offer you no relief because this doesn't fit the continuous pursuit provisions, and so there's really nothing we can offer you,
Yeah. Even
if you're successful. Whereas if you meet the continuous pursuit, they assign the effective date.
Exactly. It's a general rule exception kind of process like we have here. At N2X. The general rule is you get the date of the application of the supplemental claim. That's 5110A. And then does he fit an exception? Yeah, he's also got the 51, the continuous pursuit. So then the rules are different. It's the same with 2X1. The general rule, does he have a 5104 decision after 2019? Yes, he does. Then you don't even have to move on to the exceptions. Because it's not, he has a 5104 decision. He's in AMA. It's not a legacy claim anymore. Exceptions don't apply to him.
We've given you some extra time. You still get your full rebuttal time, Ms. Odom. And Mr. LeBlanc, you can take up to 5 minutes extra if you need it. You don't have to take it, but you can use
Let's hope not. Thank you, Mr. Chief Judge, and may it please the court. Every choice has pros and cons. Here, the appellant chose to stay in the legacy system and take advantage of its benefits. And then he chose not to appeal the October 21 Legacy Board decision. Now he wants the court to ignore those decisions and provide him with the advantages of the AMA. But Congress's framework says he can't do that and the court shouldn't provide it for him. Appellant's reading of the public law should be rejected for three reasons. First, it ignores critical context. Second, it would render the opt-in process meaningless. And third, it undermines the purposes of finality. Accordingly, the board properly dismissed the appeal of the April 22 supplemental claim because it lacked jurisdiction over that freestanding earlier effective date claim, and the court should affirm. And I welcome the court's questions. And if I could, I would like to answer a question that Chief Judge Allen asked a second ago about the legislative history. And I would say, if anything, the legislative history points to, it's that Congress intended legacy claimants to join the AMA if they chose while their claims were pending and not after they became final. In the House report on page 3, it says it would allow certain veterans who initiated an appeal prior to the bill's effective date to opt into the modernized system. And then it said to avoid overwhelming the system, the bill would limit opt-ins to claimants who receive an SOC or an SOC after the effective date of the legislation. So their reading of the law would sort of vitiate the purpose of overwhelming, because actually all legacy claimants get to become AMA claimants despite the fact that we're trying to throttle the flow of cases into the AMA. And then on page 12, it would say it would authorize VA to allow certain claimants who have an appeal pending before the effective date to opt into the modernized system. And then in the Senate report, it also says a claimant who receives a statement of the case or supplemental statement of the case in a legacy appeal, not after, in a legacy appeal, to elect participation in the new appeal system. So to the extent that there is legislative history that is relevant, we submit that it shows that Congress provided the opportunity being in 2X5 or what I'll call opt-in applicability, for that being the way, or the ramp being the way for the legacy system, legacy claimants to have the benefits of the AMA.
But couldn't 2X5 and ramp also be like valves added in so that once, assuming that if appellant's position were correct as to the statutory language, these other two would serve as valves to let people in slowly and then avoid overwhelming the system once people got their final legacy decision.
Judge Bartley, certainly.
I'm just saying you could read it either way.
Plausibly, I suppose. But I think when you look at the rest of the context and the structure, the fact that Congress chose the SOC or the SSOC, it was to put the legacy claimants in the same shoes as AMA claimants, because one of the major, in addition to continuous pursuit, one of the major changes is to the notice requirements in 5104, because there's no longer SOCs or SSOCs. So the degree of information that AMA claimants have after an initial decision under 5104 is akin to what a veteran has after an SOC or an SSOC. They have the reasons for the denial. They have the law that applies. They have all of the reasons why VA decided their claim. And then they can choose. Do they want to stay in the legacy appeal system and have its benefits of the duty to assist applying all the way to the board, no restrictions on their evidence submission, and or do they want to take the options under 5104C and pursue an AMA appeal? There are benefits to both systems, and it's clear that they would want, Congress wanted pending appeals to come into the system, not final appeals. And there are specific exceptions to the rule of finality in 7103A for motions for reconsideration and clear and obvious errors corrected by the board, and then in 7111 for clear and unmistakable error. And the court in both Rudd and Cook said because Congress provided specific exceptions to the rule of finality, they didn't intend for there to be others. And the only one that applies to effective dates is Q. And so because the filing in April of 22 was not a Q claim, it was invalid from the day it was submitted, and the board properly dismissed it as a freestanding earlier effective date claim. And to answer Judge Toth's question a moment ago, 5110A2 changed finality, and in part a comment on a question Chief Judge Allen had. It changed finality prospectively. There's nothing that says it intended to change the rules as it applies to legacy claims.
How? I mean, and again, I appreciate this is a technical question, so we can kind of take it slow. But let's assume I had my claim denied in 1995, and I read 5108 and 5104 big C, and I say, oh, you know, I want to file a supplemental claim to challenge my effective date, right? Assuming I prevailed, the adjudicator would just look at the effective date provision and say, no, you do not meet. Congress has clearly spelled out what would constitute continuous pursuit. You do not meet that. And so, you know, there's really nothing we can offer you. So they would invoke this provision against certain legacy claimants. Why would they not invoke it to others who happen to meet the continuous pursuit definition?
So a couple things, Judge Toth. First, if it was an effective date, 5108 is not an option for relief. It would only be clear and unmistakable error could be a way to get out.
I mean, practically speaking, that's right. I mean, that was Rudd, but now it's codified, right, under 5110, which is basically it would be final. It's redefined finality in a sense.
Right, but that is under the assumption of applicability of the AMA. Here you have an entire claim stream that was initiated in 2013. The initial decision on that claim was in June of 2014.
Legacy people can file supplemental claims.
They can. Yes. They can as a replacement for the claim to reopen. And if you – in 3.160E and in 3.156D, the regulations spell out that there's going to be no more claims to reopen. They're going to be supplemental claims.
How is that different?
Well, because claims to reopen start from the date of claim, And so where –
That's defined by 5110. I mean, meaning if you prevailed on the statute, some legacy people, they're going to assign the – some will meet the – I mean, they – meaning there will be legacy cases in which the board will cite literally the continuous pursuit provisions to say that they don't meet them. There will be others – so the idea is it would apply – as a rule of exclusion to some legacy people, but not as a rule of inclusion for others.
Well, because it would be applying retroactively to claims final on appeal, and absent a clear statement from Congress that that's what they intended, then the presumption is that it does not apply to those legacy claims. So as Chief Judge Allen was saying, he will get continuous pursuit, and as Mr. Purcell would have in that case, you have to have a second step in the AMA for continuous pursuit to be a concept that is relevant. So there needs to be an initial decision and then a second step taken in the AMA for continuous pursuit to be relevant.
But like in Arellano, right? And I said 5110 is complicated, and they were trying to figure out what exactly is it. Is it a procedural rule? Is it a statute of limitations? Is it? And so they stopped short of answering that. But they did say it's a substantive limitation, right? And the idea would be – and then basically the holding is – you can't just read into this statute things that aren't in the express terms of the statute themselves. In that case, it was like equitable stuff. How are we not reading into 5110 language about claims to which it's excluded? I mean, I don't understand. You could cite the public law and other things, but how is that? Where is that in 5110?
So, Your Honor, in Arellano, they were specifically construing the legacy version. So, in our view, to adopt the veterans' interpretation of the law here, you would have to add another section to the legacy version of 5110. Because in Arellano, they said there are not just time constraints, but substantive limits on the amount of recovery due. And so once the time expired for taking an appeal to this court in the legacy system, as my friend conceded in their reply brief on page 6, this claim became final for legacy purposes. And that has consequences. And so it narrows the opportunities for review after finality attaches to clear and unmistakable error or a motion for reconsideration. You don't have to add anything to the AMA version because, again, for the concept of continuous pursuit to be something, a question that you ask, there needs to be more than just an initial decision. There would need to be the initial decision and then a second step. Because you would have to have an unfavorable decision in the AMA for continuous pursuit to be relevant, because there would only be one decision. Right now, what they're trying to have is the benefits of both appeal systems, not and just ignore the fact that the claim became final. And that's not how the system is designed to operate. The rule of finality is statutorily prescribed and binds the review options available for veterans once it attaches. And so to us, if in April 2022 he had filed a Q claim and then got an unfavorable rating decision and then filed an HLR supplemental claim or 10-182 and then had a favorable outcome there, then we would look, did he file that second step in the AMA within a year? And if the answer is yes, well, then okay, then continuous pursuit is on the table. But to say that you get the benefits of both systems, notwithstanding the fact that both the legislative history and the public law itself, it doesn't say in the public law subsection 2X5, the opt-in provision compared to the first provision, 2X1, if you read it, it says in 2X1, it says, excuse me, except as otherwise provided in this section, the amendments shall apply to all claims with decisions under 5104 provided by the Secretary on or after February 19th of 2019. In subsection 2X5, it says, with respect to legacy claims, upon the issuance to a claimant of a statement of the case or supplemental statement of the case on or after the effective date, the claimant may elect to participate in the new system. If they wanted opting in to be open-ended, they could have said on or after the supplemental claim or statement of the case, but they said upon issuance. And that, in our view, is in line with the legislative history that says legacy claimants can join the AMA when they have an appeal pending, when they are in the legacy system, because that makes the most sense to where, because when they're standing at the threshold of the SOC or the SSOC, they're choosing which appeal system they want their claim to be adjudicated in. It's not, there's nothing to opt in or for the AMA to apply to once the decision becomes final, because the claim is over. It has ended. And so the next thing that happens, as Judge Greenberg said in Purcell, that starts a new claim stream. That's the first step in the procedural history. It doesn't attach to a claim that's already been final, because collateral attacks on final claims are limited to clear and unmistakable error in the effective date context.
Doesn't submitting the supplemental claim within the one-year period forestall finality?
Not for legacy claims, no, Your Honor.
What's the point, then, of VA saying that a claimant with a legacy appeal has the latter of two dates to submit an election for review under the AMA, 60 days from the issuance of the SOC or the SSOC, or the remainder of the one-year period from the date of notification of the decision under review?
Judge Jaquith, that's referencing the initial decision, which would have been in 2013. So it says that those two dates, whichever is later. And so you get the 60 days from the SOC or SSOC, so you can make that choice. Because in some instances, there would be people with initial legacy decision that would get the full year. But because there was a protracted legacy procedural history, he would get the latter of those two, which is the 60 days.
The opt-in fact sheet the veteran was provided says you can choose to have your appeal reviewed under one of the modernized appeal system options by completing the appropriate form for the review option you choose to participate in. Didn't the veteran do that by completing and submitting the specific AMA version of the supplemental claim form?
Judge Jaquith, he had 60 days to do so. So that would have been prior to the October 20th.
There's nothing that tells the veteran that.
Well, so both of them say he has 60 days to do so. The one from page 3829 of the record, it says you have 60 days from the SOC or the SSOC, or within 1 year of the appeal period, whichever is later, to opt in to the modernized system. The next sentence: opt-ins will not be accepted if received after the Board of Veterans Appeals has issued a decision on your legacy appeal. That is what Congress intended. And so we put that in the notice so veterans would be aware that once the board decides your claim, well, then your next step, as the court said in Calhoun, would be taking an appeal to this court. It's obvious whenever you read the statute in its law in context that Congress wanted to give legacy claimants an opportunity to join the AMA if they wanted to make that choice while their appeal was pending. Otherwise, he would be getting a second appeal whenever other legacy claimants haven't got that opportunity for decades, however long the legacy system has existed. So if you want the opportunity to have more agency intervention in a claim, then you would take the opportunity to opt in whenever you get the notice. And he got this notice in 2020 and in 2021 and chose not to take those options. And so on a couple of other things that I heard,
there's a second like clarity on the 60 days as a limitation beyond the 1 year period in what veterans are told. The regulation 3.2400 that says a claimant with a legacy appeal who within a year of a VA decision files for a review option under the new system has elected into the modernized system.
Whichever is later. And it notes that it references 19.52B.
It says whichever is, it doesn't say whichever is later in the regulation, but the other VA manual thing that I described for you does say whichever is later, but a year is obviously more than 60 days.
Right, but in the context of those legacy claims, if they're in a place where they have received an SOC or an SSOC greater than 1 year from the initial decision, VA's regulations were set up to give them the chance to file their formal appeal, or in this case, opt in 60 days after they received that later document. So it's set up to where it would only be those who
So that 60-day limit doesn't apply here then, because this was within 1 year.
Well, no, because it was...
How did you define the initial decision as being in 2013?
Well, he only would get 60 days from the August or July 2021 SSOC whenever he got the notice, because that would be the latest 60-day period that he could have gotten an opportunity to opt in, or if it had been an SOC, to file a VA Form 9. It's clear that there was an intention from Congress in the legislative history and in the text of the public law that these claims would that legacy claimants could join the system if they wanted to while their claim was pending. And I think, I mean, in our view, Calhoun answers this question too in the negative, which is legacy claimants do not have the option of filing a supplemental claim within a year of an adverse decision in continuous pursuit of their initial effective date. That is a feature of only the AMA. And so Mr. Berenger, at the time the October 21 legacy board decision was decided and then the 120-day period expired, he was left with only filing a Q claim. Now, he could still today, he could file a Q claim, he could file a motion for reconsideration. There's no time constraints on those filings, but once the time to take an appeal to this court ended, his claim became final, and that has meaning, that has consequences.
Doesn't the secretary's position turn on the inaccurate characterization that this was a freestanding effective date claim?
Judge Jakewith, we don't think it was inaccurate. We think it was precisely correct because the board, the agency had no authority to act on this claim because it wasn't a Q claim on the day it was filed. So the board did exactly what it should have done, which was recognize a mistake that was made and dismiss the appeal because the agency lacked authority.
That's not what the October 2021 board said, though. They said that the effective date issue was still in an appellate status.
Right, but it denied the claim. It denied the claim in the October 21 board decision, finding insufficient evidence to warrant that it was factually ascertainable that he was entitled.
But then it was the October 2023 board decision that said it was a freestanding claim based on the AOJ's action in August of 2022. And that was wrong.
No, Your Honor, it was correct because after the 120 days expired to take an appeal to this court, as the court said in Calhoun, finality attaches. And so the only way that he could have gained an earlier effective date from that point was through a motion for reconsideration or clear and unmistakable error. The fact that the August 22 rating decision denied the claim was at best a procedural mistake, and procedural errors cannot vitiate the rule of finality, as the Federal Circuit stated in Cook when they overruled Hare, when they said that a grave procedural error was a exception to the rule of finality. They said no, it was not, because Congress had not provided that as an exception to the rule of finality. So the board did exactly what it was supposed to do, which was recognize the fact that that claim had become final and that it had no authority to act on it and dismiss the appeal, which is what this court did in Rudd, because the board in that case denied the claim on the merits, and this court said we are going to vacate and dismiss the board's decision to the extent that it entertained an improper claim. And so the board only did what it was bound to do by the law that applied. And it's not carving out 5110A2D from the legacy system to do so. The fact that, as the court stated in Maddox, that Congress intended for the systems that it did not intend for the AMA to collapse the legacy rules and dissolve it, that those rules would still apply. And so the fact that finality attached has meaning, and it narrowed the veterans' options on appeal or to obtain relief. And so I would just note additionally, this reading of the law, as I stated earlier, would also render opting in meaningless. So you actually don't need to opt in. The fact that the language of the notice is clear that we're not going to accept opt-ins don't really mean anything. And as the court noted in Lloyd, the court cannot read words out of statute or adopt an interpretation that would render superfluous another part of the same statutory scheme. And that's what you would be doing here. Because
what about the board's statement that it has a policy to accept VA forms choosing AMA review options as requests to opt in, notwithstanding in any failure of veterans to mark the opt-in box on the form?
Judge, that's a policy question as a matter of our duty to liberally construe pro se filings. And so that doesn't change the framework that Congress provided. That's simply a policy choice that we're going to liberally construe the things that veterans submit. Even if they don't check the box, they're not going to be penalized for that. But it does matter if the claim has become final, because you would be asking for another appeal of a claim that had already become final, despite the fact that there are clear both Federal Circuit and CAVC precedent on this issue.
So what? Okay. Just a quick question. So what would have? How would the board have handled? What would have happened if the veteran had filed a supplemental claim within the 60 days of the October 2021 decision?
Judge Peach, if he would have filed within 60 days of the SSOC, then his claim would be evaluated by the RO to determine whether or not he had submitted new and relevant evidence. And if so, they would determine if they reopened or readjudicated the claim, then they would determine whether or not it was sufficient to warrant an effective date earlier than I believe it was 2016 that his TDIU effective date was. So he would become, his claim would be, would enter into the AMA had he done so timely.
As far as your argument about accepting appellant's position would render the opt-in meaningless, why would that be? I mean, you admitted earlier that both systems have benefits, right? And we know what they are. I won't repeat them. but if someone wanted to opt in earlier, at whenever they were issued their SSC or SSOC, they would be getting the benefit of the AMA system, different lanes for the board, et cetera, et cetera. So why would that be rendered meaningless? They could wait, or they could get it earlier. But like, what? Why does it render opting in meaningless?
Judge Bartley, because then you would actually get a second bite at the apple, notwithstanding the fact that you were given notice that opt-ins were not going to be received late, that this, and then once the board decision came out, you would get legacy appeal rights that say all these rules that apply to legacy claims. It would actually be jettisoning all of those rules that the court said in Maddox still exist in favor of giving a certain class of veterans a second opportunity to have their appeals heard whenever Congress provided this opportunity for them to have their appeals heard. So it would say that actually this is not that this section not only applies to new claims, which is what 2X1 applies to, is new AMA claims, and 2X5 applies to legacy claims. What it actually means that even though that he already had, because this whole argument that they have about the initial decision being the only August, being the only one being the August 22 one, well, you have to sort of just ignore the fact that there was an entire other claim stream. There was an entire other initial decision. So when you read the two sections of the public law, the new claim applicability and then the opt-in applicability, the answer to the first question is, did this person receive a decision under 5104 on or after the effective date of the AMA? Well, it's no, because the legacy claim existed. So whenever that claim stream has meaning for the rules that apply to it. So it would sort of diminish all of the things that the court said Congress intended in Maddox and in those passages that I said earlier from the legislative history that they intended for the legacy system to continue for a time to avoid overwhelming the AMA. So it would make this whole purpose of keeping the opt-ins limited to actually not being that limited. They're actually quite expansive, and that just doesn't really make sense in the context of the rest of the statute. And for these reasons, the court should hold that the AMA doesn't vitiate legacy finality and affirm the board's decision.
Thank you. Ms. Odom, you've got full 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I know that this is not a simple case because you all are here en banc, but it's really a simple analysis. We're getting into a lot of squishy kind of concepts here about finality and legacy, and then but this is what it is. Question one, are we in AMA or legacy? We are in AMA. I don't understand my colleague to agree with that now. It sounds like he's only talking about legacy rules, but we are in AMA. All you need to do is look at the August 22 decision. It's got the AMA 5104C rights. It's an AMA decision. We are in AMA before the court now. So question number two. Well, let me go back. I heard my colleague say X2X1 applies only to new AMA claims. You want to hold that way, Your Honors? You have to write in new to 2X1. 2X1 says A5104 decision. This court would have to write in A5104 decision on a new supplemental claim filed after February 2019. The court shouldn't do that. Question number two, what AMA rules apply when you're in AMA? The answer is all of them. If this court wants to hold differently, the court will have to write in to 2X1, the AMA amendments apply except for 5110A2D if you have a 5104 decision after 2019. Maybe there's a third question. If 5110A2D does apply, is there a way to interpret it that it doesn't apply in Mr. Barringer's situation? Sure, the court has to write rules in, or words into it. The court has to write in legacy or AMA before the board decision, not a legacy decision. So either way to get to these concepts of finality being injected into the statutory analysis, the court has to write words that Congress didn't. The court should absolutely reject that and hold that under the plain meaning of 2X.
Can I ask one question? I just want to ask a scope question that I meant to ask you in your original argument, so I'm sorry. Would Mr. Barringer's argument also apply? Assume that he appealed the relevant board decision here that had been issued in the legacy system. He appealed to the court, and the court affirmed. Would your logic also allow, and this is not a challenge, I just need to know how far it goes, could he then file a supplemental claim within 1 year of the court's decision that would then be in the AMA, then to allow to go back to get the earlier effective date, even if the court had affirmed?
Yes, because once the veteran filed the supplemental claim and there was a 5104 decision, AMA applies. So then you go to the AMA version of 5110AD or something. And that talks about continuous pursuit after a CAVC decision. So then the next step is, well, can you interpret that in some way that it doesn't apply if the CAVC decision was on appeal from a legacy board decision? Sure, but you have to write words in. That's the only way to come to that.
I wasn't challenging on the point. I just wanted to make sure that I understood that.
Yes.
Your logic would also say that.
Yes.
And are there any issues that the court runs into? I hadn't thought about it all in a lot of detail, but with respect to whether or not the decision is advisory in some sort of way or something, in the sense that, you know, the person appealing to the court would then be able to say, well, I either win or I get to continue to play to get this, but there's no way I can lose, right?
Your Honor, it's not an advisory opinion because it's opinion based on the record and the law at the time of the court's decision. If the veteran is ever going to take advantage of the 5110A2D rules, the veteran has to succeed on a supplemental claim with new and relevant evidence. So it's a different record. It's a different issue. The court's decision would not be an advisory opinion. And I just want to touch very quickly, Judge Bartley, on your concern about the discussion about people who start in legacy and then get into AMA, somehow getting, having their cake and eating it too and getting two bites at the apple. So does everybody who got a board remand in legacy and then opted in after an SOC. Those people got the benefits of the duty to assist at the board. They got the full record windows in legacy, and then opt in years later and got all the AMA benefits. That's exactly what Congress intended. And Congress intended that the lifespan of a claim as it moved on through time would eventually turn into an AMA claim, either through an opt-in before a legacy board decision or because the veteran continued to pursue the claim after the AMA system went into effect. And if there aren't any other questions, then I would urge the court to reverse the board's dismissal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
So we thank all the parties for the repeat performance here. We appreciate that, and we appreciate all the briefing and argument you've done in this case. And so the court will come down and greet counsel, and the case is submitted.